Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 26th of March with me, Ian Welsh. As part of our regular series of interviews, a few days ago I spoke with Cargill's Heather Tansey, who is Sustainability Director for Animal Nutrition and Health. We talked about how Cargill is working to reduce methane emissions from cattle and the challenges involved. That's coming up a little later. And in the run-up to Innovation Forum's Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference next month, also coming up is another chance to hear an interview I recorded just after last year's event with Ruth Farrell, Textiles Marketing Director at Eastman Naya, and Andres Ortolano, FSC Italy Chain of Custody Manager, when we talked about the role of certification in helping develop sustainable wood pulp supply chains for the apparel sector. In addition, there are some updates about this year's apparel event coming up in a few weeks' time on the 27th to 29th of April. However, no news this week, that'll be back next time. The Innovation Forum team has been busy holding the first in our Future of Food Spring conference series this week. There have been some fascinating discussions and workshops, and it's been a real pleasure to meet some podcast listeners in the networking sessions. Our next conference is this year's Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Forum from the 27th to 29th of April. And I caught up with Innovation Forum's Hannah Halmari to find out how the preparations are coming along. Welcome back to the podcast, Hannah.
Thanks, Ian. Happy to be here.
We had a workshop a couple of weeks ago, which was looking forward to our Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference, which is coming up on the 27th to 29th of April next month. We had a workshop looking at the roadmap to regenerative apparel. So what were the highlights for you from the workshop?
The workshop was fantastic and all of the speakers were really great and really provided a lot to take away from each session. But I have to say, one that really stood out to me was the session on the farmer perspective. So this was with Matt Mayer of Thousand Hills Lifetime Grazed and Nathaniel Siemens of Rodale Institute's California Organic Center. And just, you know, hearing from them on what the term regenerative means on the farmer level and what regenerative practices actually look like on the ground, the challenges and opportunities associated with these, it was really interesting and it just really helped ground the term regenerative apparel that we do see flying around so much in the industry these days.
Yes, it was a very interesting session. I was lucky enough to be chairing that session. It was a fascinating discussing all the regenerative practices that are coming along. And in fact, it links in very well with what we're doing this week. We're in the middle of our Future of Food USA event this week, which is, again, talking about all these practices in agriculture. So it's all linking together very well. Are there any new sessions or speakers coming up at the Sustainable Apparel event next month? Anything new that we should know about?
Yeah, we've confirmed a number of new speakers and I'm really excited to hear from them. So we have Kathleen Talbot, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Reformation, Kate Heine, the Director of Corporate Responsibility at Zalando, and the iconic designer Catherine Hammett herself.
Excellent. Well, that'd be fantastic. Look forward to that very much indeed. Tell me a bit about what you think the delegate experience will be like. What should delegates expect from the event?
They can look forward to 3 days of really engaging, interactive and focused sessions. They'll have the chance to hear from and ask questions to over 60 expert speakers from across the whole industry. We'll be discussing and debating the salient environmental and social issues in the apparel space. And as always, we'll have a strong focus on the practical solutions and best practice. Delegates will actually have access to the platform in the next few weeks. So they'll be able to start adding sessions to build out their own personal agenda. And they can also start scheduling meetings with the other attendees. And I really encourage everyone to make the most of the networking opportunities provided, including the speed networking sessions that we'll be running on each of the conference days.
Yes, the speed networking has become a feature of Innovation Forum events, and I thoroughly enjoy them. They're a great way to get to meet other delegates. It replaces the sort of water cooler moments at events where you just bump into people and strike up a conversation. I really enjoy them and I find them very useful. Okay, well, Hannah, looking forward to the event very much next month, the 27th to 29th of April. Tickets still available, of course. We'll check back in with you in the next few weeks as we get closer to the event, as we hear that the final details are coming together. But Hannah, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks, Ian.
As part of our ongoing podcast series with Cargill, I recently spoke with Heather Tansey, Sustainability Director, Animal Nutrition and Health, and Protein and Salt. We discussed Cargill's work cutting methane from cattle and the key points to consider when thinking about an effective methane mitigation plan. So we're going to be talking a bit about the impacts of methane and what Cargill's doing to counter these, which is part of your Beef Up programme. Methane is well known as a significant greenhouse gas, but it's one I think that people don't know that much about. So can you give a bit of context for the significance of methane? How much methane is there in the atmosphere and what's its impact and where does it come from?
So like all greenhouse gas emissions, methane emissions have been growing over time. And really, after carbon dioxide, it's the most significant greenhouse gas that's contributing towards global warming. And if you think about it, methane contributions have increased about 150% over pre-industrial levels. So methane emissions really come from both natural sources or anthropogenic, or what we call man-made sources. So natural sources of methane include things like wetlands, termites, oceans. But when you think about man-made sources of methane, there's really kind of four key ones. One is fossil fuels. The second is agriculture, which I think we're going to talk about a fair amount here today. The third is waste. So really, as waste degrades in landfills, methane is released. And then finally, biomass burning. I mentioned methane is really one of the most potent greenhouse gas emissions. And to put it into perspective for you, it's 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. But one of the things that's also, I think, really interesting about methane is it's much shorter lived in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. And what that means to me as a sustainability practitioner, it means that if we lean into reducing methane today, we can have a big impact on the climate. So if we think about like what methane means in terms of agriculture, livestock represents about 14% of global greenhouse gas emissions associated with human activities. And then if we narrow down into beef, you know, what percentage beef plays in that global 14% really depends on the regions of the world that you're in. If we think about beef production in the US, it's about 3.7% of our total emissions, with methane being the bulk of the greenhouse gases associated with beef.
What then are the key points to consider when thinking about an effective methane mitigation plan?
I think the key thing to always remember is that there really isn't a silver bullet out there. When you think about feeding, say, a growing population, beef has and will continue to play an important role in providing protein. But there's also, I think we have a responsibility with any food production to look at ways to build a more sustainable supply chain. And I get particularly excited about the opportunities in the beef space, because there's a lot of innovation and technology out there and emerging to help us address methane emissions from beef cattle. When you approach developing a methane mitigation plan, I think you really want to think about, take a place-based approach, think about the geography that you're working in and the needs of that particular farm. You want to think holistically about how you manage that. And it's everything from on-farm management strategies, poor animal nutrition and health, all the way through to things like rumen modifiers and different feed additives that can actually impact the generation of enteric methane emissions and methane emissions from cattle.
Dealing with the methane that cattle are responsible for, I guess it's part of a kind of realistic look at the food sector, you accepting that cattle are here to stay. If we eliminate cattle, then we don't have this methane problem. I guess that's not a realistic approach. You say, well, cattle is going to remain a part of people's diets and an important part of people's diets, so therefore we have to approach things from that perspective.
Correct. You know, I think Cargill believes that all sectors across our food chain need to drive towards reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. All sectors have a role to play. So our beef production system sits in North America, and our North American production system is actually 35% more efficient than the global average for beef production. But we still believe that we can make it even more efficient. And that's what our Beef Up Sustainability Initiative is really focused on, is working in partnership with producers and our supply chain partners to drive a more efficient beef production system. And one of the things that's, you know, particularly exciting about my role, which, as you introduced me, I work both on our protein side of the business, but also on our animal nutrition and health side of the business. And it's really through our animal nutrition and health side that we are developing core nutrition solutions that help increase the productivity of beef cattle and dairy cattle. We're also doing research looking at things like rumen modifiers that are working towards reducing enteric methane emissions. So just to take a step back, when we think about the methane emissions associated with cattle, right, the methane emissions come from kind of two sources. One, cattle eat grass and other materials that humans, as an example, couldn't eat. Our stomachs couldn't handle that. But cattle have a four-chamber stomach, and there are microbes in their stomach that break down. They have a symbiotic relationship with the animal, and they break down that plant material into nutrients that that animal can absorb. But a waste product of those microbes is methane. and the cattle burp out that methane as part of just sort of their daily life. And that methane emissions goes up into the atmosphere and leads towards global warming. So we know that we can potentially impact that by changing the biology of what happens within the animal. And it could be that by introducing things like lemongrass or seaweed or other plant extracts, that we're able to mitigate those methane emissions.
Let's come to enteric fermentation specifically in a sec. Can you just perhaps place it with the context of overall cattle methane emissions? I mean, I imagine there's more to emissions of methane from cattle than one might initially think.
Enteric methane emissions from cattle really come from two areas. One, it's the methane emissions, I should say, come from two areas. One, it's enteric fermentation, so the cattle burping. You know, maybe that's probably the bulk of the methane emissions from cattle. And then the other piece is from manure that's left on pasture. So when cattle bakes manure, there is some off-gassing that happens from that manure of methane that goes into the atmosphere. And those are really the two main sources from a cattle.
Are there regional differences that affect that? Is it different in different parts of the world, say?
Carbon emissions from cattle, or the carbon footprint of cattle, really varies greatly based on different geographies. So if you look at, say, a production system in sub-Saharan Africa, you're going to have a significantly higher carbon intensity from producing a pound of beef than you are in areas like Europe or North America, where we have highly efficient production processes. And so when you're thinking about how best to address the greenhouse gas emissions associated with beef, you really want to think about what area of the world that you're in. So if you're working in sub-Saharan Africa, you want to start with core nutrition and really about improving productivity and efficiency on farm. If you're looking at reducing the footprint from a farm, say, or a ranch in North America, where many of those practices have been in place for decades, that's where you might want to lean into things like potentially rumen modifiers and new innovation in feed additives that may be able to impact that enteric fermentation.
Let's talk about enteric fermentation. Not something I would have thought I ever would say, but let's talk about it anyway. Enteric fermentation is essentially the fermenting of what the cattle eat in their stomach. So how can that be tackled specifically?
So enteric fermentation, which is really the digestive process that happens within those ruminants that have multiple stomachs. So we're talking about cattle, we're talking about sheep, any ruminant. It's a naturally occurring phenomenon. And there's really a few ways that you can potentially influence that. So you might look at feed additives, which could influence, alleviate, or convert that methane production. And there's really a number of different technologies and products out there. So scientists and researchers are currently exploring things like probiotics. They're looking at, you know, seaweed, you hear a lot about, as a potential addition to cattle diets, plant extracts, and other solutions. What we're looking at is how to utilize that methane gas and turn it into CO2 and other gases that have less of a global warming potential, or potentially to inhibit the growth of microbes that are producing that methane within the stomach. It could also be just changing that fermentation pattern in a way that reduces the overall carbon and global warming potential of emissions that those cattle.
Okay, so it's dealing with the chemistry of what's going on in the cow's stomach then, is it?
Correct.
What sort of impact then do these solutions have on milk yields in dairy, if you've covered that, or meat quality, and any other consequences for the animal?
Yeah, it really depends on the solution itself. You've honed in on, I think, what is a really critical point when we think about rumen modifiers that are addressing enteric methane. You know, when our researchers at Cargill are thinking about it, we believe that any product that's going to be effective on the market cannot have any negative impacts on animal health, animal welfare, on the product that's being produced, and really on the performance of that animal. You know, we think that those are table stakes that cannot be impacted. And so we're looking at solutions that actually not only don't impact those areas negatively, but, you know, we believe that a successful solution will also need to provide benefits in those areas, really improve welfare, health, performance, or product output.
Can effective methane reduction be undertaken in organic conditions?
Yes, methane emissions can absolutely be reduced under organic conditions. You know, we need to keep in mind that methane production is a natural process that happens within the rumen of a ruminant. or part of its manure. It's an important part of the carbon cycle, but we can manage it through different feed and nutrition. We would just want to make sure that the feed additives and the nutrition being fed to the animal was also organic and met those standards.
Thinking to the future then, ultimately, what is the potential for the methane reduction technology that is being developed?
I think there is so much potential in this space. It's really exciting to me to think about what we can do in the beef sector in terms of building a more sustainable beef sector and really reducing greenhouse gas emissions and enteric methane emissions. You know, if you think about everything from just implementing better core nutrition that improves productivity on farm in areas where we have more inefficient systems, all the way through to some of these exciting practices like rumen modifiers in areas like North America and Europe, where we've already optimized for many of those nutrition pieces. It's so exciting. And then when you couple that work with really the, I think, some of the exciting advancements that we're seeing in grazing methodology and regenerative agriculture, which we didn't even get to scratch today, together, you know, I think we have the opportunity to build a highly efficient beef sector that will enable beef to be a very low carbon protein into the future. And it's exciting to me to see that beef cattle can really be a force for good when it comes to addressing issues like climate change.
It does feel that over the last year to 18 months, a lot of things have developed which are showing us the tools that we will need to get to net zero emissions for the agricultural sector. It's all very exciting. But to that, perhaps methane reduction will be a big part of the solution. For now, Heather Tansey from Cargill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian.
Coming up now is another chance to hear a discussion recorded following 2020's Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference, when I spoke with Ruth Farrell, Textiles Marketing Director at Eastman Naya, and Andres Ortolano, FSC Italy Chain of Custody Manager, about developing sustainable wood fibre supply for the sector. Let's start with a bit of context. I'd like both of you to very quickly introduce yourselves and outline how you guys work together. So Ruth, turning to you, a bit of context as to what Eastman's doing in the apparel sector and how you work with FSC.
So again, my name is Ruth Farrell and I work as marketing director for the Eastman textiles business. And we produce Naya, which is a cellulosic acetate fiber, which is primarily used in women's wear fashion. And it's manufactured with wood pulp that's sourced from sustainably managed forests and plantations. And the FSC connection. So as you know, sustainability is becoming more and more important in textiles. Certifications and standards play a very important role in that. For us, FSC certification is giving our customers, both our direct customers, our mills, but our indirect customers, the brands also, a confidence that the material they're sourcing has been responsibly sourced and it's contributing to forest conservation through implementation of social and environmental practices. And for me, as a fiber producer, a cert like FSC provides a transparency, a traceability, and an overall assurance. So we're working quite closely with FSC and our partners to really build the importance of this certification, but also the importance of having, you know, best practice forestry management across our supply chains. That's the connection for us.
Andres, perhaps same question to you then. A bit of context as to what FSC is doing in the apparel sector and why you're involved in the sector.
As you said, I'm in charge of technical support regarding chain of custody certification in FSC Italy. FSC Italy is one of the national offices involved in the FSC, in the Forest Stewardship Council network. I'm following, together with other FSC, European FSC offices, a project called FSC Infection. Our task is to develop the certification in the sector among the textile in general. Regarding our connection and collaboration with Naya, our approach is always to establish a collaborative relationship with certified companies. Eastman certainly is a very important player among the forest-based artificial producers. We are very happy that Eastman has chosen FSC certification and consequently to protect forests and have a positive impact on forest from which is its supplied. So we want to help Eastman to communicate the values of the certification, emphasize the shoes that Eastman has taken. And of course, we collaborate to spread these values in the market and among Eastman's customers.
Ruth, from your perspective, what are the challenges sourcing sufficient wood pulp? And what are the kind of risks inherent in the wood pulp supply chain for you?
Well, let me start with the risks. Our primary concern is to ensure that there is protection of ancient and endangered forests and forests of high conservation area. And the concern and the risk, of course, is that in certain regions, forestry practice may threaten old growth forests and contribute to deforestation, for example. And that, of course, has a negative impact on biodiversity and the ecosystem in general. To address those risks, we start with our sourcing policy. And I would say our pulp sourcing policy has evolved in the last several years to become something that's very robust. And we prohibit sourcing of wood pulp from ancient and endangered forests or any areas where there's any controversial risk. And that, of course, limits the number of suppliers in the market. We are looking to have pulp suppliers that really have the same level of commitment to the protection of ancient and endangered forests and that they take it very seriously, that they see ecological impacts as front of mind in how they approach their forestry management. It is challenging to find those partners, and I think working with FSE helps us in that regard, because together we can encourage suppliers of wood pulp to engage in best practice forestry management and to really take seriously the needs of protection of endangered and old growth forests. So it is challenging, but we're very collaborative with both FSE and indeed suppliers in the market. Our view is really to try and educate and build an awareness as we bring new suppliers into our supply stream for the NIAF portfolio.
What's the trend in the challenges to find suppliers? Is it becoming easier? Are you finding suppliers are becoming more in tune with your requirements for certification and for certainty?
The fashion industry in general is becoming much more aware of the importance of the fibre choice. So we did a research recently with consumers and asked them their opinion on what makes clothing items sustainable or environmentally friendly. And 7 out of 10 cited the material selection. So you're seeing brands and indeed now consumers very focused on making sure that their fibre choice is an eco-responsible fibre choice. And in looking at that fibre choice, they also want to know where that fibre is coming from and what the supply chain is, what the value chain is. And we're seeing more and more in sourcing policies with brands that we're working with, that this is becoming a feature. So if you look at brands in the market right now who are really championing sustainability, H&M, Inditex, Eileen Fisher, Stella McCartney, and many others, you'll see that they're very strong on their sourcing policy. They're working with organizations like FSE, like Canopy, and really trying to build in the importance of sourcing responsibly their cellulose. And that is driving the rest of the supply chain to really meet those demands of brands and indeed ultimately the demands of the consumers. So I'm seeing much, much more interest in responsible sourcing of pulp throughout the supplier base right now. So that's very encouraging to see, and the momentum is just increasing. And my view is that post this COVID crisis that we're going through right now, that will continue to increase with the heightened awareness and concern around the environment.
You talked about consumers. Is the importance for consumers changing? I mean, they're looking now for certainty in your sourcing, I would imagine. Is that where certification helps?
Yeah, certification and standards across the range. You know, you have FSE obviously on sourcing, but you have Oakitex, you have Higgs Index, and a number of different certifications and standards that are becoming much more important. And really what the consumer is looking for is an assurance and a transparency and a traceability so that they can actually have trust and confidence that the garment that they're buying is indeed environmentally sound.
Andreas, what changes in demand have you noticed from the apparel sector for wood pulp?
Of course, there is a change in the demand. We can split this change in two different changes. One concern quality and the other concern quality. Quality related not to technical quality, but to sustainability, something that concerns the sustainable of the product. Regarding the first one, we can say that the global man-made cellulosic fiber production increased from 5.9 million of tons in 2014 to 6.7 million of tons in 2018. So there is more demand of this kind of fibers. But this increase in the demand, in the quantity, is connected to the increase in the quality of this demand. In the quality, as I said, related to sustainability. Companies and brands know the origin of those fibers. They want to know that those fibers don't come from endangered forests and these fibers don't have a negative impact on the world's forests. As an example, I can say that in Italy, before 2016, there was no one FSC certified companies selling fabrics, FSC fabrics or FSC yarns. But now we can count more than 60. I think that we are around 65 companies only in Italy certified for selling yarns or fabrics that come from well-managed forests. In the end, so we can say that there is an increase in the global interest regarding forest-based fibers, but that increase is strictly linked to a focus related to the importance of know the origin of that fibers and to know that that fibers are sourced from well-managed forests and that the impact of that sourcing is not negative.
And how are you leveraging this changing demand from FSC to boost your profile and to increase your work?
Due to a very strict standard, FSC have obtained the trust of both consumers and companies. And also thanks to that companies that use the FSC label on their products, FSC has managed to create a good level of awareness of its values. So now we can see that FSC is a well-known brand in a lot of sectors, in particular in the printed sector and the packaging sector and other wood sectors. In the textile sector, we have to build this awareness. We have to create it because FSC exists since more than 25 years, but FSC has entered in the textile world only during the last 3-4 years. So this is a new sector for FSC. As all new things, this is a challenge for us because we know that this sector is different from all the other that we usually work, have also other kinds of problems. FSC is not and doesn't want to be the solution to all problems, but we are eager to be part of the solution associated to forest-based textiles. I think that there is a high potential for the cellulosic fiber market to contribute to the sustainability management of the world forests. In the end, we can say that this changing demand is consistent to the historical moment. The historical moment that we are living in. And that if it is addressed in the right way, it will benefit both the mission of FSC and the fashion industries.
Question for both of you. Ruth, what are the challenges around scaling up wood pulp-based fibers in apparel supply chains?
For Naya, we're actually a high specialty pulp buyer. So not every grade of pulp is suitable for Naya production. So for us, actually, finding the right partners is key, but it's also a lot of work. In the last several years, we have been looking, we have expanded our pulp supply to 3 suppliers, and we're very fortunate that we have a close working relationship with them. And all 3 have protection philosophy for ancient and endangered forests and are very, very committed around sustainable forest management. And we continue to look for more suppliers. And what I would say is, in general, there's an increased momentum in this area where the supply chains are really embracing the importance of best practice forestry management. And that is fueled, of course, by increasing brand awareness, increasing consumer awareness. My feeling is that the future is very positive and that more and more pulp suppliers will embrace best practice forestry management. And again, I see FSC as part of that because FSC gives the whole value chain in textiles a sense of assurance because it's a very, very strong brand in itself that gives trust to our customers and their customers.
Okay, same question then to Andres. Challenges for you, Andres, in terms of scaling up. Is demand likely to outstrip supply in terms of the demand for wood pulp from the apparel sector?
Of course, that increase of demand is a challenge. FSC promotes its mission through market approach. An increase in demand for FSC certified products will lead an increase in FSC certified forests. An increase in FSC certified forests will lead a positive environmental impact globally. That's what we think. That positive impact will be reflected in a positive sustainable textile fashion industry. The challenge for us will be to drive these demands towards a sustainable forest products that can ensure that forest ecosystem, the need and the right of the current generation without compromising those of the future generations. The FSC label is the guarantee of that. The FSC label carries the same message all over the world, and the message is a product that comes from a well-managed forest.
As ever, look out at innovationforum.co.uk for all the usual audio interviews and insights, including a new op-ed piece from regular guest contributor Paul Honan about business's role in eliminating gender bias. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.